Thanks very much. I'd like to ask if people would mind just standing up for 1 minute with me. And I'm just going to go around, and when I just touch you very gently, would you please turn your back? All of those beautiful faces are hidden to us now. And that's what happens when people leave their community and go into prison. They're not visible anymore. In some ways, they're excluded. In some ways, they're hidden from our view and hidden from their families, just as those faces are hidden from us now. So thanks for participating in that. You can turn back around and sit down. Thank you. Pretty much, I think a lot of people in this room probably or may have seen a television program. Maybe Doug can remind me if it was the 70s or the 80s. It was groundbreaking. It was called Roots. And if you haven't seen it, I'll just recreate briefly for you.
Yeah, 1970s.
An indigenous young man was on a trip with his family from Central Africa to the coast. And during his, I think it was his vision quest, at any rate, he was free and moving in his indigenous dress through the jungle, through the bush. And he was suddenly grabbed by people whose language he didn't understand. And he had been treated respectfully all of his young life and was enslaved and thrown into a ship and transported in chains across the ocean to the New World. This is exactly what happens to people when they go to prison, except maybe the framework is a little different now. Maybe the context is different now. That was a colonial approach on the screen. That was the effect of the colonial approach, was to remove people from their environment and their home and their language and their culture by force, either by enslaving them or killing them. Now we come forward to 2005. It's not acceptable in what we call North America, which I will challenge in a minute, that title, that term, but it's not acceptable to do that to people now. So even though we know it still happens, just go with me for a minute. Going into the Bronx or into Chicago or into Toronto or Vancouver's drug areas that are so famous. Hastings, is it? Hastings Avenue in Vancouver. And going in there and pulling out people based on the color of their skin, based on if they have piercings and their hair a certain way, their clothing, the way they're dressed, is exactly the same thing. It is an extension of the colonial attitude that people can be removed with an agenda. And sometimes that agenda it has to be justified by making the laws reflect what society, supposedly mainstream society, does not accept as far as behavior, dress, etc. Where do you start? For me, I'm 56 years old. I've lived many years and walked many miles on these little feet here, and I've seen a lot of things come in and out of fashion. One of the things that I've seen over and over again is the inside of prisons. I saw the inside of a prison the first time when I was probably about 9 or 10 years old. And I went in there with my stepfather's family to visit my Uncle Bobby, who was a heroin addict. And as a part of trying to get heroin, he broke into houses and he was really good at it. But eventually, he got caught. And so he broke this law and he went to prison for, 4 or 5 years or something like that. And we went in there to visit him, and all the people to me, at the age I was, had the same expression. So they reminded me of like a baseball team or a football team. And I'm trying to return to the sensibility of an 8 or 9-year-old child. They all looked the same. And at the time I didn't know why. Why did they look the same to me? Well, it's true, looking back, they were wearing the same clothing. Because in those days, there was a very strict dress code that you had to follow with pinstriped. If you've ever seen the old mattresses with the stripes, that's what prisoners used to have to wear back then. And so that was my first experience inside the prison, and family sitting at little tables and people, drinking Cokes and eating chips and stuff like that. And the guy's all sort of sitting a certain way, like body language was, kind of like this, kind of. You know, either that or there was people hunched over like this, trying to not show other people that they were crying with their mother or their girlfriend. So that was my first experience. My second experience in the prison system was when I was 18 years old and I was marching against the Vietnam War. And the reason I was marching against the Vietnam War was because the guys I grew up with and had a crush on and, you know, wanted to go out with, and went out with a couple of them, were being shipped over to Vietnam and coming back in body bags. And that really upset me, because at the same time, there were no images that I saw of the jungle being blown up, but I knew it was happening. And when I started, I couldn't find that information in a newspaper or on TV. I had to go to the university to find people that were talking about it and to be able to find those images, because those images were hidden from public view. Once I saw those images, I knew the truth of what was being hidden from me, was that a pristine jungle, a beautiful part of Mother Earth, was being bombed and napalmed and burnt. Because why? And the people that were being sent over there and being killed by the hundreds and thousands were mostly my age, 18 years old. The old guys in Washington weren't going. They were like, yes, go, yes, go. But that's not who was going. So for me, as a young person at the time, that's why I got this tattoo. Because for me, I needed to say something with my body and with my voice that this was wrong. The revolution, you know, I saw the first picture of Che Guevara, about the same time as that. And again, this was not taught in school. It wasn't on TV, it wasn't on the radio, it wasn't in the media in any way. The image that was being promoted was this kind of suit and tie, you know, off to church, off to work with your little lunchbox and all that. That was what was being promoted. And the youth were not accepting that. They just weren't accepting that. There was more to it than that. And so people took to the streets by the thousands and eventually by the millions to protest the destruction of a country for an idea that didn't belong over there, for reasons that had nothing to do with their lives, for taking away their choice, their political choices, their physical choices. This was something that was extremely important to my group of activists in the 60s. And beyond that, I felt extremely guilty that anybody would have the nerve to think it was okay to destroy life in such a violent manner. Not just one village, not just one person, not just a battalion of soldiers that were armed, but people nursing their babies, women tending their gardens, elderly men having tea, an entire ecosystem of incredible plants and animals destroyed by fire as hot as the sun. I was so outraged. Not only was I outraged as a thinking human being, but I was outraged as an Aboriginal person. My roots go into the earth, and to imagine that could be done by my government, well, I'll tell you what it made me. It made me a Canadian. That's what it made me. It made me a Canadian. I could not bear it. But before it made me a Canadian, it made me an activist. And so I marched. And at that time, and as I mentioned to Samir, I think by email, there was huge resistance by the status quo for anybody that appeared to be fair. And I am an enigma because I am Aboriginal, but it's the Irish that shows on the outside. And so I was marching with my black brothers and sisters. And that was not acceptable in New Orleans in 1966. So, you know, I had to be dealt with, me and others like me. And one way to do it was we all smoked pot. So it was easy to set us up and buy a little pot from an agent and off you go to prison with a 10-year sentence. Yeah. Fortunately for me, I was able to negotiate somewhat and I wound up with only 5 years. And out of that 5 years, I did 2 inside the prison walls. And inside the prison walls, there was no philosophy. there was no politics. There was no, you know, this, you did this for this reason, and it was survival, plain and simple. And most of the people that were there were people that were poor. There was a lot of black people there. But at that time, there was still segregation in the prison system, so I was with the white ladies, and there was a huge fence that went up about 25 feet with barbed wire on the top, and then the other side, it was all the black ladies on the other side. We worked on crews together, we worked in the kitchen together, we did jobs together, but we didn't sleep together. And the only matrons or guards that were in that building at night were black also. So there was still, that was that edge of segregation that I still experienced. And one of the things that I kept asking myself over and over again, you know, when I would talk to people, is there was nobody there, number one, that was a person of privilege, with one exception. One exception. There was no one there that was a person of privilege. The people that were of privilege, their parents were able to pay off the lawyer, they were able to pay off the judge, they were able to get them a suspended sentence. So from my own visceral experience, I can tell you that the women I spent 2 years with were all poor. Majority of them were poor. Most of them did not have an education outside of, say, grade 7 or 8. Many of them had killed an abusive partner. Many of them were addicts. Many were addicts. Most were addicts. A lot of them, did I say that they'd been prostitutes? Yeah. And guess what? They didn't beat the crap out of me in the shower like they do in the movies. They welcomed me. They gave me a birthday party when I turned 21 in prison, but I wasn't doing life without food. I found that people, the compassion, the level of compassion that was there, once you got to know people, was wonderful. And I learned a lot. I grew up. I became a woman in there.